Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do more from Saki, his novel, The Unbearable Bassington. We're going to do chapters 9 and 10. Let's begin. Chapter 9. In the warmth of a late June morning, the long shaded stretch of raked earth, gravel walk, and rhododendron bush that is affectionately known as the Row, capital R, was alive with a monotonous movement and alert stagnation appropriate to the time and place. The seekers after health, the seekers after notoriety and recognition, and the lovers of good exercise were all well represented on the galloping ground. The gravel walk and the chairs and long seats held a population whose varied instincts and motives would have baffled a social catalog maker. The children, handled or in perambulators, might be excused from instinct or motive. They were brought. Pleasingly conspicuous among a bunch of indifferent riders pacing along by the rails where the onlookers were thickest, was Courtney Ugel on his handsome plum roan gelding, and de joyeuse. That delicately stepping animal had taken a prize at Islington and nearly taken the life of a stable boy whom he disapproved, but his strongest claims to distinction were his good looks and his high opinion of himself. Ugel evidently believed in thorough accord between horse and rider, so Ugel had a horse like him as a high opinion of itself. "Please stop and talk to me," said a quiet, beckoning voice from the other side of the rails, and Ugel drew rein and greeted Lady Viula Kroot, V-E-U-L-A-C-R-O-O-T. Lady Viula had married into a family of commercial solidity and enterprising political nonentity. She had a devoted husband, some blonde, teachable children, and a look of unutterable weariness in her eyes. To see her standing at the top of an expensively horticultured staircase, receiving her husband's guests, was rather like watching an animal performing on a music hall stage. One always tells oneself that the animal likes it, and one always knows that it doesn't. "Lady Viula is an ardent free trader, isn't she?" someone remarked to Lady Caroline. "I wonder," said Lady Caroline, in her gently questioning voice, "a woman whose dresses are made in Paris and whose marriage has been made in heaven might be equally biased for and against free imports." Lady Viula looked at Ugel and his mount with slow critical appraisement, and there was a note of blended raillery and wistfulness in her voice. "You two dear things, I should love to stroke you both, but I'm not sure how Joyeuse would take it. So I'll stroke you down verbally instead. I admired your attack on Sir Edward immensely, though of course I don't agree with a word of it. Your description of him building a hedge round the German cuckoo and hoping he was isolating it was rather sweet. Seriously, though, I regard him as one of the pillars of the administration." "So do I," said Ugel. "The misfortune is that he is merely propping up a canvas roof. It's just his regrettable solidity and integrity that makes him so expensively dangerous. The average Briton arrives at the same judgment about Roan's handling of foreign affairs as Omar does of the supreme being in his dealings with the world. He's a good fellow, and all 'twill be well." Lady Viula laughed lightly. "My party is in power, so I may exercise the privilege of being optimistic. Who is that who bowed to you?" she continued, and a dark young man with an inclination to stoutness passed them by on foot. "I've seen him about a good deal lately. He's been to one or two of my dances." "Andrei Drakuloff," said Ugel. "He's just produced a play that has had a big success in Moscow and is certain to be extremely popular all over Russia. In the first three acts, the heroine is supposed to be dying of consumption. In the last act, they find she is really dying of cancer." "Are the Russians really such a gloomy people?" "Gloom-loving, but not in the least gloomy. They merely take their sadness pleasurably, just as we are accused of taking our pleasures sadly. Have you noticed that dreadful Klopstock youth has been pounding past us at shortening intervals? He'll come up and talk if he half catches your eye. I only just know him. Isn't he at an agricultural college or something of the sort? Yes, studying to be a gentleman farmer, he told me. I didn't ask if both subjects were compulsory. You're really rather dreadful, said Lady Viola, trying to look as if she thought so. Remember, we are all equal in the sight of the sight of heaven. For a preacher of wholesome truths, her voice rather lacked conviction. So women like hearing people criticized. If I and Ernest Klopstock are really equal in the sight of heaven, said Hugo with intense complacency, I should recommend heaven to consult an eye specialist. There was a heavy spattering of loose earth and a squelching of saddle leather as the Klopstock youth lumbered up to the rails and delivered himself of loud, cheerful greetings. Joyeuse laid his ears well back. I don't know why a male horse would have a female name. As the ungainly bay cob and his appropriately matched rider drew up beside him, his verdict was reflected and endorsed by the cold stare of Hugel's eyes. "I've been having a nailing fine time," recounted the newcomer with clamorous enthusiasm. "I was over in Paris last month and had lots of strawberries there. Then I had a lot more in London, and now I've been having a late crop of them in Herefordshire. So I've had quite a lot this year." And he laughed as one who had deserved well and received well of fate. "The charm of that story," said Hugel, "is that it can be told in any drawing room." And with a sweep of his wide-brimmed hat to Lady Viola, he turned the impatient Joyeuse into the moving stream of horses and horsemen. "That woman reminds me of some verse I've read in Light," thought Hugel, as Joyeuse sprang into a light, showy canter that gave full recognition to the existence of observant human beings along the sidewalk. "Ah, I have it." And he quoted aloud, as one does in the exhilaration of a canter. "How much I loved that way you had of smiling most when very sad, a smile which carried tender hints of sun and spring, and yet, more than all other thing, of weariness beyond all words." And having satisfactorily fitted Lady Viola onto a quotation, he dismissed her from his mind. With the constancy of her sex, she thought about him, his good looks, and his youth, and his railing tongue, till late in the afternoon. While Hugo was putting Joyeuse through his paces under the elm trees of the row, a little drama in which he was directly interested was being played out not many hundred yards away. Elaine and Comus were indulging themselves in two pennyworths of park chair, drawn aside just a little from the serried rows of sitters who were set out like bedded plants over an acre or so of turf. Comus was, for the moment, in a mood of pugnacious gaiety, dispersing a fund of pointed criticism and unsparing anecdote concerning those of the promenaders or loungers whom he knew personally or by sight. Elaine was rather quieter than usual, and the grave serenity of the Leonardo da Vinci portrait seemed intensified in her face this morning. In his leisurely courtship, Comus had relied almost exclusively on his physical attraction and the fitful drollery of his wit and high spirits, and these graces had gone far to make him seem a very desirable and rather lovable thing in Elaine's eyes. But he had left out of the account the disfavor which he constantly risked and sometimes incurred from his frank and undisguised indifference to other people's interests and wishes, including at times Elaine's. And the more that she felt that she liked him, the more she was irritated by his lack of consideration for her. Without expecting that her every wish should become a law to him, she would at least have liked it to reach the formality of a second reading. Another important factor he had also left out of his reckoning, namely the presence on the scene of another suitor who had also youth and wit to recommend him, and who certainly did not lack physical attractions, Comus, marching carelessly through unknown country to effect what seemed already an assured victory, made the mistake of disregarding the existence of an unbeaten army on his flank. So he doesn't realize just how much women like money and position and status, particularly an older man when they're younger as she is. And he's not even thinking about that. Today Elaine felt that, without having actually quarreled, she and Comus had drifted a little bit out of sympathy with one another. The fault, she knew, was scarcely hers. In fact, from the most good-natured point of view, it could hardly be denied that it was almost entirely his. The incident of the silver dish had lacked even the attraction of novelty. It had been one of a series, all bearing a strong connecting likeness. There had been small, unrepaid loans, which Elaine would not have grudged in themselves, though the application for them brought a certain qualm of distaste. With the perversity which seemed inseparable from his doings, Comus had always flung away a portion of his borrowings in some ostentatious piece of glaring and utterly profitless extravagance, which outraged all the canons of her upbringing without bringing him an atom of understandable satisfaction. So he's loose with other people's money, not to mention the woman he might want to marry. Under these repeated discouragements, it was not surprising that some small part of her affection should have slipped away, but she had come to the park that morning with an unconfessed expectation of being gently wooed back to the mood of gracious forgetfulness that she was only too eager to assume. It was almost worth being angry with Comus for the sake of experiencing the pleasure of being coaxed into friendliness again with the charm which he knew so well how to exert. It was delicious here under the trees on this perfect June morning, and Elaine had the blessed assurance that most of the women within range were envying her the companionship of the handsome, merry-hearted youth who sat by her side. With special complacence, she contemplated her cousin Suzette, who was self-consciously, but not very elatedly, basking in the attentions of her fiancé, an earnest-looking young man who was superintendent of a people something or other on the south side of the river, and whose clothes Comus had described as having been made in Southwark rather than in anger. That would mean something if you knew something about those things back then, but you can certainly tell from the context what is meant. Most of the pleasures in life must be paid for, and the chair ticket vendor in due time made his appearance in quest of pennies. Comus paid him from out of a varied assortment of coins and then balanced the remainder in the palm of his hand. Elaine felt a sudden foreknowledge of something disagreeable about to happen, and a red spot deepened in her cheeks. 4 shillings and 5 pence and a halfpenny, said Comus reflectively. It's a ridiculous sum to last me for the next 3 days, and I owe a card of debt over £2. Yes, commented Elaine dryly and with an apparent lack of interest in his exchequer statement. Surely, she was thinking hurriedly to herself, he could not be foolish enough to broach the matter of another loan. The car debt is rather a nuisance, pursued Comus with a fatalistic persistency. You won £7 last week, didn't you? Asked Elaine. Don't you put any of your winnings to balance losses? The 4 shillings and the 5 pence and the halfpenny represent the rear guard of the £7, said Comus. The rest have fallen by the way. If I can pay the £2 today, I dare say I shall win something more to go on with. I'm holding rather good cards just now. But if I can't pay it, of course, I can't show up at the club. So you see the fix I'm in. Elaine took no notice of this indirect application. The appeal court was assembling in haste to consider the new evidence, and this time there was the rapidity of sudden determination about its movement. She's had about enough of this clown show. The conversation strayed away from the fateful topic for a few moments, and then Comus brought it deliberately back into the danger zone. It'd be awfully nice if you'd let me have a fiver for a few days, Elaine, he said quickly. If you don't, I really don't know what I shall do. If you are really bothered about your card debt, I will send you the £2 by messenger boy early this afternoon. She spoke quietly and with great decision. And I shall not be at the Connors' dance tonight, she continued. It's too hot for dancing. I'm going home now. Please don't bother to accompany me. I particularly wish to go alone. Notice the use of particularly, a way that we would not see it used today, but it's perfectly valid. Comus saw that he had overstepped the mark of her good nature. Wisely, he made no immediate attempt to force himself back into her good graces. He would wait till her indignation had cooled. His tactics would have been excellent if he had not forgotten that unbeaten army on his flank. Elaine de Frey had known very clearly what qualities she had wanted in Comus, and she had known, against all efforts at self-deception, that he fell far short of those qualities. She had been willing to lower her standard of moral requirements in proportion as she was fond of the boy, but there was a point beyond which she would not go. He had hurt her pride, besides alarming her sense of caution. Suzette, on whom she felt a thoroughly justified tendency to look down, had at any rate an attentive and considerate lover. Elaine walked toward the park gates, feeling that in one essential, Suzette possessed something that had been denied to her, and at the gates she met Joyeuse and his spruce young rider preparing to turn homeward. "Get rid of Joyeuse and come and take me out to lunch somewhere," demanded Elaine. "How jolly," said Hugo. "Let's go to the Corridor restaurant. The head waiter there is an old Viennese friend of mine and looks after me beautifully. I've never been there with the lady before, and he's sure to ask me afterwards in his fatherly way if we're engaged." The lunch was a success in every way. There was just enough orchestral effort to immerse the conversation without drowning it, and Hugo was an attentive and inspired host. Through an open doorway, Elaine could see the café reading room with its imposing array of Neue Freie Presse, Berliner Tageblatt, and other exotic newspapers hanging on the wall. She looked across at the young man seated opposite her, who gave one the impression of having centered the most serious efforts of his brain on his toilet and his food, and recalled some of the flattering remarks that the press had bestowed on his recent speeches. "Doesn't it make you conceited, Courtenay," she asked, "to look at all those foreign newspapers hanging there and to know that most of them have got paragraphs and articles about your Persian speech?" Hugo laughed. "There's always a chastening corrective in the thought that some of them may have printed your portrait. And once you've seen your features hurriedly reproduced in the matin, for instance, the morning in French, you feel you would like to be a veiled Turkish woman for the rest of your life." And Hugo gazed long and lovingly at his reflection in the nearest mirror as an antidote against possible incitements to humility in the portrait gallery of fame. Elaine felt a certain soothed satisfaction in the fact that this young man, whose knowledge of the Middle East was an embarrassment to ministers at question time and in debate, was showing himself equally well informed on the subject of her culinary likes and dislikes. If Suzette could have been forced to attend as a witness at a neighboring table, she would have felt even happier. "Did the head waiter ask if we were engaged?" asked Elaine when Courtenay had settled the bill and she had finished collecting her sunshade and gloves and other impedimenta from the hands of obsequious attendants. "Yes," said Hugo, "and he seemed quite crestfallen when I had to say no." "It would be horrid to disappoint him when he's looked after us so charmingly," said Elaine. "Tell him that we are." So, a little step of boldness herself. So Comus quite undid himself, and she realized she would rather have a grown man than a boy. And maybe he lost something significant. We'll have to see. That's the end of chapter 9. Chapter 10. The Rutland galleries were crowded, especially in the neighborhood of the tea buffet, by a fashionable throng of art patrons which had gathered to inspect Mervyn Quentock's collection of society portraits. M-E-R-V-Y-N, Quentock. Quentock was a young artist whose abilities were just receiving due recognition from the critics. That the recognition was not overdue, he owed largely to his perception of the fact that if one hides one's talent under a bushel, one must be careful to point out to everyone the exact bushel under which it is hidden. It's from the Bible, of course. There are two manners of receiving recognition. One is to be discovered so long after one's death that one's grandchildren have to write to the papers to establish their relationship. The other is to be discovered, like the infant Moses, at the very outset of one's career. Moses found in the rushes in the river. Again, also from the Bible, Mervyn Quentock had chosen the latter in happier manner. In an age in which many aspiring young men strive to advertise their wares by imparting to them a freakish imbecility, Quentock turned out work that was characterized by a pleasing, delicate restraint. But he contrived to herald his output with a certain fanfare of personal eccentricity, thereby compelling an attention which might otherwise have strayed past his studio. In appearance, he was the ordinary, cleanly young Englishman, except perhaps that his eyes rather suggested a library edition of the Arabian Nights. His clothes matched his appearance and showed no taint of the sartorial disorder by which the bourgeois of the garden city in the Latin Quarter anxiously seeks to proclaim his kinship with art and thought. I guess that means he wasn't a trendy type. His eccentricity took the form of flying in the face of some of the prevailing social currents of the day, but as a reactionary, never as a reformer. He produced a gasp of admiring astonishment in fashionable circles by refusing to paint actresses, except, of course, those who had the legitimate drama to appear between the boards of Debrett. That's like a social register of nobility, I think. He absolutely declined to execute portraits of Americans unless they hailed from certain favored states. His watercolor line, as a New York paper phrased it, earned for him a crop of angry criticism and a shoal of transatlantic commissions. And criticism and commissions were the things that Quentock most wanted. He wanted to be talked about and paid. "Of course he is perfectly right," said Lady Caroline Benaresque, calmly rescuing a piled-up plate of caviar sandwiches from the neighborhood of a trio of young ladies who had established themselves, hopefully within easy reach of it. "Art," she continued, addressing herself to the Reverend Poltimore Varden, "has always been geographically exclusive. London may be more important from most points of view than Venice, but the art of portrait painting, which would never concern itself with the Lord Mayor, simply grovels at the feet of the Doges. As a socialist, I'm bound to recognize the right of Ealing to compare itself with Avignon, but one cannot expect the Muses to put the two on a level. Those are the Greek Muses that would talk in the ear, the inspiration that leads to art. That is how the Greeks perceived art, coming from Muses to artists. "Exclusiveness," said the Reverend Poltimore, "has been the salvation of art, just as the lack of it is proving the downfall of religion. My colleagues of the cloth go about zealously proclaiming the fact that Christianity, in some form or another, is attracting shoals of converts among all sorts of races and tribes that one had scarcely ever heard of, except in reviews of books of travel that one never read. That sort of thing was all very well when the world was more sparsely populated, but nowadays, when it simply teems with human beings, no one is particularly impressed by the fact that a few million, more or less, of converts of a low stage of mental development," note what you could say 100 years ago that wouldn't be printed now, "that a few million, more or less, of converts of a low stage of mental development have accepted the teachings of some particular religion. It not only chills one's enthusiasm, it positively shakes one's convictions when one hears that things one has been brought up to believe as true are being very favorably spoken of by Buryats and Samoyeds and Kanakas." The Reverend Poltimore Varden had once seen a resemblance in himself to Voltaire and had lived alongside the comparison ever since, so he thinks he's very witty. "No modern cult or fashion," he continued, "would be favorably influenced by considerations based on statistics. Fancy adopting a certain style of hat or cut of coat because it was being largely worn in Lancashire and the Midlands. Fancy favoring a certain brand of champagne because it was being extensively patronized in German summer resorts. No wonder that religion is falling into disuse in this country under such ill-directed methods. It's downclassing. You can't prevent the heathen being converted if they choose to be," said Lady Caroline. "This is an age of toleration." "You could always deny it," said the Reverend Poltimore, "like the Belgians do with regrettable occurrences in the Congo. But I would go further than that. I would stimulate the waning enthusiasm for Christianity in this country by labeling it as the exclusive possession of a privileged few. If one could induce the Duchess of Pelm, for instance, to assert that the Kingdom of Heaven, as far as the British Isles are concerned, is strictly limited to herself, two of the undergardeners at Pelmby, and possibly, but not certainly, the Dean of Dunster, there would be an instant reshaping of the popular attitudes towards religious convictions and observances." "To be sought after something has to be exclusive," he's saying. "Once let the idea get about that the Christian Church is rather more exclusive than the lawn at Ascot, That's, you know, they have Ascot Day, they have horse race, and they all go out in those ridiculous hats. Once let the idea get about that the Christian church is rather more exclusive than the lawn at Ascot, and you would have a quickening of religious life such as this generation has never witnessed. But as long as the clergy and the religious organizations advertise their creed on the lines of, everybody ought to believe us, millions do, one can expect nothing but indifference and waning faith. Time is just as exclusive in its way as art, said Lady Caroline. In what way? Said Reverend Poltimore. Your pleasantries about religion would have sounded quite clever and advanced in the early 90s. Today they have a dreadfully warmed-up flavor. That is the great delusion of you would-be advanced satirists. You imagine you can sit down comfortably for a couple of decades saying daring and startling things about the age you live in, which, whatever other defects it may have, is certainly not standing still. The whole of the Sherard Blois school of discursive drama, and that's not the first shot he's taken at Bernard Shaw, the whole of the Sherard Blois school of discursive drama suggests to my mind early Victorian furniture in a traveling circus. However, you will always have relays of people from the suburbs to listen to the mockingbird of yesterday and sincerely imagine it is the harbinger of something new and revolutionizing. So she's basically, well, he's using this minister to attack a type and basically saying Shaw is part of that type, and he's been mocking the same things in the same way for 20 years, I guess, and it's outdated. The age has changed. It seems to me what he's saying. Like I say, that's not the first shot he's taken at Bernard Shaw, who would be considered a larger figure by far than he is. Would you mind passing that plate of sandwiches? Asked one of the trio of young ladies, emboldened by famine. With pleasure, said Lady Caroline, deftly passing her a nearly empty plate of bread and butter. I meant the plate of caviar sandwiches. So sorry to trouble you, persisted the young lady. Her sorrow was misapplied. Lady Caroline had turned her attention to a newcomer. A very interesting exhibition, Ada Spelvex, it was saying. Faultless technique, as far as I am a judge of technique, and quite a master touch in the way of poses. But have you noticed how very animal his art is? He seems to shut out the soul from his portraits. I nearly cried when I saw dear Winifred depicted simply as a good-looking, healthy blonde. I wish you had, said Lady Caroline. The spectacle of a strong, brave woman weeping at a private view in the Rutland Galleries would have been so sensational. It would certainly have been reproduced in the next Drury Lane drama. And I'm so unlucky, I never see these sensational events. I was ill with appendicitis, you know, when Lulu Bremengard dramatically forgave her husband after 17 years of estrangement during a state luncheon party at Windsor. The old queen was furious about it. She said it was so disrespectful to the cook to be thinking of such a thing at such a time. Lady Caroline's recollections of things that hadn't happened at the court of Queen Victoria were notoriously vivid. It was the very widespread fear that she might one day write a book of reminiscences that made her so universally respected. As for his full-length picture of Lady Brickfield, continued Ada, ignoring Lady Caroline's commentary as far as possible, all the expression seems to have been deliberately concentrated in the feet. Beautiful feet, no doubt, but still hardly the most distinctive part of a human being. To paint the right people at the wrong end may be an eccentricity, but it is scarcely an indiscretion, pronounced Lady Caroline. One of the portraits, which attracted more than a passing flutter of attention, was a costume study of Francesca Bassington. Francesca had secured some highly desirable patronage for the young artist, and in return, he had enriched her pantheon of personal possessions with a clever piece of work into which he had thrown an unusual amount of imaginative detail. He had painted her in a costume of the great Louis's brightest, brightest period, seated in front of a tapestry that was so prominent in the composition that it could scarcely be said to form part of the background. Flowers and fruits and exotic profusion were its dominant note. Quinces, pomegranates, passion flowers, giant convolvulus, great mauve-pink roses. and grapes that were already being pressed by gleeful cupids in a riotous Arcadian vintage stood out on its woven texture. The same note was struck in the beflowered satin of the lady's kirtle, K-I-R-T-L-E, and in the pomegranate pattern of the brocade that draped on the couch on which she was seated. The artist had called his picture Recolte, R-E-C-O-L-T-E, and after one had taken in all the details of fruit and flower and foliage that earned the composition its name, one noted the landscape that showed through the broad casement in the left-hand corner. It was a landscape clutched in the grip of winter, naked, bleak, black frozen, a winter in which things died and knew no reawakening. If the picture typified harvest, it was a harvest of artificial growth, sort of a symbol of her being kicked out of the house she loved so much, since her second bridge has fallen through with Comus yielding to the charms of Courtney Ugel. "It leaves a great deal to the imagination, doesn't it?" said Ada Spelvexit, who had edged away from the range of Lady Caroline's tongue. "At any rate, one can tell who it's meant for," said Serena Golackly. "Oh, yes, it's a good likeness of dear Francesca," admitted Ada. "Of course it flatters her." "That, too, is a fault on the right side in portrait painting," said Serena. "After all, if posterity is going to stare at one for centuries, it's only kind and reasonable to be looking just a little better than one's best." "What a curiously unequal style the artist has," continued Ada, almost as if she felt a personal grievance against him. "I was just noticing what a lack of soul there was in most of his portraits. Dear Winifred, you know, who speaks so beautifully and feelingly at my gatherings for old women, he's made her look just an ordinary dairymaidish blonde, and Francesca, who is quite the most soulless woman I've ever met, he's given her quite..." "Hush," said Serena, "the Bassington boy is just behind you." Comus stood looking at the portrait of his mother with the feeling of one who comes suddenly across a once-familiar, half-forgotten acquaintance in unfamiliar surroundings. The likeness was undoubtedly a good one, but the artist had caught an expression in Francesca's eyes which few people had ever seen there. It was the expression of a woman who had forgotten for one short moment to be absorbed in the small cares and excitements of her life, the money worries and little social plannings, and had found time to send a look of half-wistful friendliness to some sympathetic companion. Comus could recall that look, fitful and fleeting, in his mother's eyes when she had been a few years younger, before her world had grown to such a committee room of ways and means. Almost as a rediscovery, he remembered that she had once figured in his boyish mind as rather a good sort, more ready to see the laughable side of a piece of mischief than to labor forth a reproof. That the bygone feeling of good fellowship had been stamped out was, he knew, probably in great part his own doing. And it was possible that the old friendliness was still there under the surface of things, ready to show itself again if he willed it, and friends were becoming scarcer with him than enemies in these days. Looking at the picture with its wistful hint of a long-ago comradeship, Comus made up his mind that he very much wanted things to be back on their earlier footing, and to see again in his mother's face the look that the artist had caught and perpetuated in its momentary flitting. If the projected Elaine marriage came off, and in spite of recent maladroit behavior on his part, he still counted it an assured thing, much of the immediate cause for estrangement between himself and his mother would be removed, or at any rate, easily removable. Oh boy, he's going to get a surprise, isn't he? With the influence of Elaine's money behind him, he promised himself that he would find some occupation that would remove from himself the reproach of being a waster and an idler. There were lots of careers, he told himself, that were open to a man with solid financial backing and good connections. There might yet be jolly times ahead in which his mother would have her share of the good things that were going, and carking thin-lipped Henry Greech and other of Comus's detractors could take their sour looks and words out of sight and hearing. Thus, staring at the picture as though he were studying its every detail and seeing really only that wistful, friendly smile, Comus made his plans and dispositions for a battle that was already fought and lost. So this kid is going to get a crisis point in his life where he's going to have to either grow up or change the way he is, or at least he's going to fully realize the cost of the way he has lived his entire life. The crowd grew thicker in the galleries, cheerfully enduring an amount of overcrowding that would have been fiercely resented in a railway carriage. You know, it's like an art exhibit opening, even if you've probably been to one or two of those yourself. You know how it is, and they're probably passing around refreshments and stuff. I haven't been to a lot, but I've been to a few of those. It can be kind of fun for a little while. Now, let's see. It gives people a chance to circulate and talk to each other and look at each other, and they're usually pretty well dressed up, and they're kind of at their best. Near the entrance, Mervyn Quentock was talking to Serene Highness, a lady who led a life of unobtrusive usefulness, largely imposed on her by a good-natured inability to say no. "That woman creates a positive draft with the number of bazaars she opens," a frivolously spoken ex-cabinet minister had once remarked. At the present moment, she was being whimsically apologetic. "When I think of the legions of well-meaning young men and women to whom I've given away prizes for proficiency in art school curriculum, I feel that I ought not to show my face inside a picture gallery. I always imagine that my punishment in another world will be perpetually sharpening pencils and cleaning palettes for unending relays of misguided young people whom I deliberately encouraged in their artistic delusions. Do you suppose we shall all get appropriate punishments in another world for our sins in this?" said Quentock. "Not so much for our sins as for our indiscretions. They are the things which do the most harm and cause the greatest trouble. I feel certain that Christopher Columbus will undergo the endless torment of being discovered by parties of American tourists. You see, I am quite old-fashioned in my ideas about the terrors and inconveniences of the next world. And now I must be running away. I've got to open a free library somewhere. You know the sort of thing that happens. One unveils a bust of Carlyle and makes a speech about Ruskin, and then people come in their thousands and read Rabid Ralph or Should He Have Bitten Her? Don't forget, please, I'm going to have the medallion with a fat Cupid sitting on a sundial. And just one thing more. Perhaps I ought not to ask you, but you have such nice, kind eyes. You embolden one to make daring requests. Would you send me the recipe for those lovely chestnut and chicken liver sandwiches? I know the ingredients, of course, but it's the proportions that make such a difference. Just how much liver to how much chestnut, and what amount of red pepper and other things. Thank you so much. I really am going now." Staring round with a vague half-smile at everybody within nodding distance, Her Serene Highness made one of her characteristic exits, which Lady Caroline declared always reminded her of a scrambled egg slipping off a piece of toast. At the entrance, she stopped for a moment to exchange a word or two with the young man who had just arrived. From a corner where he was momentarily hemmed in by a group of tea-consuming dowagers, Comus recognized the newcomer as Courtenay Ugel and began slowly to labor his way towards him. Ugel was not, at the moment, the person whose society he most craved for in the world, but there was at least a possibility that he might provide an opportunity for a game of bridge, which was the dominant desire of the moment. The young politician was already surrounded by a group of friends and acquaintances and was evidently being made the recipient of a salvo of congratulation, presumably on his recent performances in the Foreign Office debate, Comus concluded. But Ugel himself seemed to be announcing the event with which the congratulations were connected. Had some dramatic catastrophe overtaken the government? Comus wondered. And then, as he pressed nearer, a chance word, the coupling of two names, told him the news. "My gosh, can you even stand for this novel cliffhanger dramatic ending? How will Comus react to this? It's going to be very interesting. I mean, this book novel is studying the characters, see how these people change and evolve over time as they learn new things from their experiences in the world. Very, very interesting. Anyway, that's enough for today. That's two chapters, times about 40 minutes seems to be the right speed with which to do this novel. But I've been Alex Linder, reading to you from Hector Human Rose Saki, his novel or novella, as it's about 90 pages, is The Unbearable Bassington. This has been chapters 9 and 10. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.